This is tape number one, the afternoon of January the 7th, 1961. President Noyes and Hillman. Dave was just asking for some including remarks about Cleveland.
Well, the biography of Cleveland that was written about, I guess, about 15 years ago, covers the situation very well and tells a great many stories about him that places him, at least in his first administration, as a man who was very much interested in the welfare of the ordinary man. But after he was defeated in 1888, and he had the majority of the popular vote, but he was defeated in the Electoral College. He then went to work for the Prudential Insurance Company and became one of the directors of Princeton University. And when he was re-elected in 1892, his viewpoint had substantially changed from what it was while he was president the first time. And he called out the troops in Chicago when they had the
Haymarket
strikes and the Haymarket riots, you might call them, but it was a strike. And then he became very much convinced that William Jennings Bryan was wrong, and he went for William McKinley in 1896, and his son followed through with that and became the leader of the Republican Party in Baltimore, Maryland. And the only reason for Cleveland's standing in the history of the country is because he was elected on the Democratic ticket twice.
Now, did he take the role of management in all those labor strikes that were erupting during that period?
No. He suppressed the riots and the interference with the United States mails. I don't think he was substantially on the side of the people who were what you might call the people who controlled the financial affairs of the government. This was a strike, what he considered a strike against the government of the United States.
Well, there was the railroad strike, and it was more or less engineered by Eugene Debs, wasn't it?
Well, that's, yes,
part
that
of
strike
it.
Was...
They jailed him, too, didn't they?
Yes, he was put in jail and finally pardoned. But the strike was not really against the government, against the industry. It was against the government's movement of the mails.
Well,
that's what caused the Cleveland's interference.
Well, that was in 1894, the Pullman.
1893.
Yes, May 1894.
Pullman
Palace Guard. Sent federal troops to Chicago to stop obstruction of mails by Pullman Company strikers.
That's right. And that's the way it came about. He used the fact that it was an interference with the delivery of the United States mails, which was a federal program. And I don't think he was substantially on the side of industry, although he was inclined that way after his re-election in 1890.
Well, organized labor was militant at that time and radical, and it fight the reactionary managements. They went to the management, then went to the courts and got injunctions. Wasn't that the period during which you got a federal injunction if you violated
yes.
it and went to jail?
And that was the reason for the law that prevented injunctions in labor affairs. I think the old man from Nebraska was the man who was the reason for that law, which prevented the injunctions in labor strikes.
Now the what was that senator for whom a dam was named in Norris, Senator Norris.
Norris, he's the one.
Mr. President, would you then categorize the whole Cleveland presidency, first and second, as being one on the liberal side, or don't you wonder? You don't want to define it as liberal.
I think he was much more on the side of the common people than he was on the other side, and I don't like the word liberal because it doesn't mean what it says.
Right, I agree. And then the second administration was a case where he had a change of heart and a change of mind. And
that's
more or less behaved pretty much as a Republican president would have been in his place.
That's my opinion. And he expressed the opinion when McKinley was elected that he was very glad that Bryan was not elected.
But it was during his second administration, wasn't it, that he sent the message to Congress denouncing Great Britain's refusal to arbitrate with Venezuela in territorial disputes.
Yes, and that's one of the great things that he did. He upheld the Monroe Doctrine in that case. That's one of his great decisions.
That was in his second term, then.
Second term.
That's right. It was in his second term.
So that his vigor as a president was intact, but his leanings were the other way.
That's right. That's right.
Now, Mr. President, would you then inform us a little bit about what his struggle with William Jennings Bryan was, and what were the issues?
Oh, well, he was against free silver. You see, Bryan's program was that the circulating medium was based on a gold standard at $20 and a fraction as the value of a gold dollar, an ounce of gold. And Bryan's idea was that the increasing of the circulating medium would meet some of the difficulties with which we were faced. Were faced at that time. And the idea that he had in mind was to make remonetized silver and coin silver on the same basis that gold was coined at the rate of 16 to 1. That is, the 16 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold. And the cry was that he was an advocate of counterfeit money. Well, when Woodrow Wilson came along, became president of the United States, he set up the Federal Reserve Board and issued the money on the basis of the assets of the country instead of the gold dollar. And he accomplished the same purpose that Bryan intended to accomplish by 16-1.
Other issues with Bryan were his progressive outlook upon the government's relations with labor, or didn't that come into the picture at all?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. That was a part of the whole layout. And Bryan kept alive the progressive program in the interest of the people, the common people, as against the special interests. And eventually, the administrations of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt carried through the program on in which Bryan was interested. I don't know what would have happened if Bryan had become president, but it makes no difference about that because he was on the side of the people who have no representation in Washington. People that the president is supposed to represent. Some of them have, and some of them have not represented them.
Just to speculate a little, what kind of a president would Bryan have made, in your opinion?
Well,
nobody
knows. Nobody knows what kind of president he would have made. But he couldn't have made one that would have been looking backward for the welfare of the country. I think the chances are that he would have made a good president because you can't tell what a man will do until he gets there.
Would he have been dangerous and impractical in his view?
I don't think so. I don't think so because he would have had to surround himself with the people who would have given him good advice, and always the Congress is there to check dangerous programs by a president.
But he was a man equipped with a very dangerous instrument if provocatively used his great oratorical power.
Well, I don't know whether that was an asset or a liability. He was the greatest orator of his time. But it isn't that that gets programs through Congress.
But he was no demagogue in your judgment.
No, I don't think so. He was talking for the people who had no representation at that time. And of course, the opposition press, those who were against him, called him a demagogue. I don't think he was.
He did get involved in two rather doubtful programs. One was the Scopes monkey trial, and the other one was his submerged real estate to a lot of unsuspecting people.
I was always very sorry that he got mixed up with the Scopes trial, but I didn't know anything about the submerged land.
Oh, yes, he was selling real estate. He was lecturing about the opportunities for real estate in Florida, and he touched off the Florida boom, as you know, and a lot of people got badly stuck.
Well, his way
yes, but
of
I think
time.
You'll find, I think you'll find that most of the land which he was touting at that time became exceedingly valuable after he was dead.
Well, it's not
I went down there and took a look at it.
It took several generations
and a
few more millions of the country and some special laws to retire people to Florida.
That happened in the winning of the West. It happened in every new country that's ever been settled by.
Several groups of pioneers go broke, and then the ones who come along at the right time reap the harvest. They're the smart people.
That's absolutely correct.
Men
who are ahead of the times always cause disaster by being too enthusiastic for what they believe in, but eventually, if they're right, their beliefs will come true. And that's what happened in Bryan's case in Florida.
Well, as long as you're having an expansionist economy, you're bound to catch up sooner or later with the
values. Yes, but two or three recessions was the cause of Bryan's trouble.
Well, there was one in, 1897, was that the...
1893
was the big...
That's right. And, of course, there was another one in 1907 when Theodore Roosevelt was president, and tried to cover that up, but it was one of the bad recessions. And then, of course, the great one came along in 1929.
Cleveland do about the financial panic of 1893, if you recall?
He didn't think there was anything he could do. He just liked to take scores. He didn't do anything, Donovan.
Did he guarantee to redeem everything in gold during
no, no, he never made any guarantee, I'm sure.
I just wondered whether he didn't invoke the gold standard completely.
Well, the gold standard is in effect. He didn't have to invoke it.
But there was some question of coining of greenbacks even during that period.
Well, yes, but the greenbackers had been substantially defeated along in the early 80s. And I don't think he had any idea.
So this was a period of sound money then?
Well, what they call sound money. What they call sound money. Whether it was or not, I don't know.
If we've got a little space there, I would like to ask the President just one of those very iffy questions again. Are these recurring panics, these periodic panics that have been occurring ever since then and do occur now, and you had a lot of experience with that, are they preventable?
No, I don't think they are. They're usually the result of too much speculation. They're also the result of a gambling approach to the increased fundamental basis of the expansion of the country as a whole. And I don't know how you're going to stop it.
But
1837 was the first bedroom we had right after Jackson's administration.
But we didn't have anything very serious under your administration, because by that time a lot
of
crops were.
Well, we had two or three recessions, but we met them as best we could, and it didn't amount to anything.
Stand at tape 1 the afternoon of January 7th, 1961. This is tape 2 of the afternoon of January 7th, 1961.
Just to continue in that row for a second, you are still of the opinion that certain recessions are part and parcel of the free economy and there's nothing you can do about preventing them altogether?
Well, they can't be prevented altogether, especially when the speculators get control of things. The great land speculation was the cause of the 1837 panic. And the one in 1873 was the result of the tremendous expenditures that were necessary in the war between the states. The one in 1893 was a result of speculation in the stock market, as was the one in 1929. And the establishment of the Securities and Exchange Commission since 1929 has been supposed to be a break on the too much speculation, which usually brings about a panic.
You don't think it has fulfilled that purpose?
Not since the Democrats went out of office.
Yep.
We want to go on to Benjamin Harrison
yes,
now.
Yes, we do.
Just briefly, because he was not too important a president, was he, sir?
No, he was one of the presidents that didn't do much and was hopeful that the Congress would take charge and do things that were necessary. And he was one of the presidents that we consider he was one of the third-class presidents, let's put it that way. We have three classes of presidents. We have great ones, those who were near great, and those who didn't do anything, and Harrison was one of them.
Now, would you have a fourth classification for those who managed to do some considerable damage?
Well, I don't think there's been any single president that I can think about right now who really did damage because he wanted damage to be done. I think you'll find that most of them were anxious to have things done. Some of them didn't act in their position as chief executive as they should, and that brought about some of the difficulties. But I don't think any of them willfully and maliciously tried to get the country into trouble.
I think what is interesting, Mr. President, that in 1900, Benjamin Harrison practiced law and served in Paris as chief attorney for Venezuela in the Venezuela-Great Britain boundary dispute.
Yes, I know that. That's what he did. But Cleveland took care of that before he went out of office.
Yes. Nothing else that we want to say about Benjamin Harrison?
No, there's not much you can say, except he was president of the United States.
All right, so we
and then maybe that you want to make comment of the fact that he was the grandson of the former president.
He was the grandson of
the only one of
William Henry Harrison. And he and the Adamses are the only ones who had a family connection with the president in two or three generations.
Also noted having the first $1 billion Congress or something, didn't they vote?
Well, yes, that was in 1890. But just before Benjamin Harrison went out, they had a $1 billion Congress, and I don't know what they'd have done if they'd had a $70 billion Congress as they have now.
Well, now, Mr. President, we come to the man whose ghost still walks, and it's William McKinley.
Well, William McKinley was a major in the Federal Army in the war between the states. He was elected in 1896 on the Republican ticket on the program of a full dinner pail for working people. And it was in the same class with log cabin and hard cider in William Henry Harrison's time. And the objective of that was to inform the laboring people that unless they voted the Republican ticket for McKinley, they'd lose their jobs and they wouldn't have anything to eat.
Well, now, we had a little skirmish with the Maine and the Havana Harbor during the period, and during McKinley's time, we got into our difficulties with Spain, didn't we?
Yes, that brought on the Spanish-American War in 1898. McKinley was elected in 1896 and took office on March 4th, 1897. And the Maine was torpedoed and sunk in Havana Harbor in 1898. And
February 15th,
1898. And the Hearst Press and a lot of the other demagogue press associations in the country really forced McKinley into the War with Spain. But in that War with Spain, that put us in the class of a world power, because Spain lost Puerto Rico and Cuba and the Philippine Islands, and We took over the government of those...
Puerto Rico and Guam, too?
Well, Guam goes along with the Philippines.
I see.
The Philippines. But the result of that was a free government in the Philippines, a free government in Cuba, and a government in Puerto Rico, which is very satisfactory to the people there. They've just overwhelmingly endorsed it in the last election. Cuba, for some reason or other, has gone haywire on the subject, and it's too bad.
Hawaii was also annexed to the United States at that during his administration.
Well, at their request. It wasn't because we wanted them. They were annexed because they requested that it be done.
That was in 1898, too, but that was by an act of Congress.
I don't remember exactly how they approached it, but it was... it was after the Spanish-American War.
Yes, 1898, by an act of Congress.
That's right.
Well, now,
at their request, we didn't do it because we wanted to take them home.
Well, then, McKinley's administration was pretty crowded with some historic events from the standpoint of this hemisphere.
That's true.
What was his role in the thing? Did he merely inherit these events, or did he create them or generate them?
They came about while he was president, and he carried them through. He didn't create them, or he didn't inherit them. They came about during his administration with the sinking of the Maine and the bringing on of the Spanish-American War. And then there was a great deal of discussion, I can remember it as a youngster, about whether we should annex Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippine Islands, which we didn't do. Cuba would have been much better off if we hadn't have annexed them. They probably would be at state in the Union now if we had.
There was always a considerable pressure for the annexation of Cuba to the United States.
Yes, that's right.
Of course, Admiral Dewey, or Commodore Dewey at first, was a man who played a role in the defeat of the Spaniards.
Well, that was in
Manila
Bay. That was in the West.
Yeah.
And that's when he took over the Philippines after Dewey's victory.
What shape were we in at that time? Were we still empire? Minded? Were we empire building?
No, I don't think so. The ideas in that day was to stay on this continent between the two oceans, which everybody felt was the, what you might call, the ditches that prevented the foreigners from coming our way. And that was in a day when was slow transportation across the seas, and they considered the Pacific and the Atlantic the best defenses that we had.
So we were protecting our flanks in this hemisphere rather than...
That's right, and that's the reason for the hesitation as to what to do with the Philippine Islands. They were outside of our bailiwick. They were in the Eastern Hemisphere, and we didn't know what to do with them.
We finally made
a republic out of them, though.
I noticed that in November 1900, the first automobile show was held in New York City, so I suppose it was just the beginning of the development of the automobile in the country.
Well,
and I noticed, too, that William McKinley was the first president to use a telephone for campaign purposes. In 1896, he telephoned 38 of his campaign managers in as many states from the residence at Canton, Ohio, on matters pertaining to the campaign.
Front porch campaign. McKinley didn't make campaign. He sat on the front porch and had the people come see.
Of course, you're talking about a period during which the everything of any major industrial mechanization suddenly burst forth on the world. We've developed out of this country a number of ingenious mechanical devices with the harvester and the Pullman car and the train and all those things. And this was where the industrial work of the United States began
to
take shape.
That's right. The beginning of this century is where it began.
Could you reflect a little bit on that and come to some notion as to why all these enormous... We just came out of this terrible war between the states, and at the same time, this enormous outpouring of creative genius began to take place in this country to match the resources that we were beginning to uncover?
Well, two of the great things were the invention of the cotton gin and the invention of the McCormick reaper and binder. food program, and then the invention of cultivator, on which you could ride and cultivate two rows of corn instead of one, and then along came the gang plow, which was pulled by four horses or mules to plow two furrows instead of one, and went on from that to the invention of the tractor and the beginning of the real industrial age, not only in agriculture but in steel and everything else. And it's one of the greatest ages ever happened in the history of the world. It began in 1900 and ran up until the present time, and they're still inventing things.
The amazing thing is that here in these United States, a raw, uncultured, self-conscious, rather socially clumsy behaving society, all of these things began to develop, and yet in countries like England and Germany and France and Italy, where they were mechanically advanced, none of these things had developed.
Well, some of them did. Now, the Wright brothers, who were bicycle manufacturers over in Ohio, were interested in dynamics and invented the first flying machine. Now, the first steam engine that pulled a train was invented in Great Britain. First train was pulled by an engine invented by, I think, a fellow by the name Stevenson, who was spelled P-H-E-N, not B-E-N.
Right.
And he was one of the preliminaries of this arrangement. Now, the French then took up aviation, and if you remember, the first flight across the channel was made by a Frenchman, Blériot, I think his name was. And you'll find that after the freedom of thought was finally released in this country and in the other free countries, that is Britain and France, invention began to go forward to the point where we reached these periods in which we live now, with the automobile and the airplane and the explosive engine. The auto engine, is, as you remember, was the first engine that was on the explosive basis, and the Selden patent on that engine was one of the drawbacks to the improvement of the automobile. And when that patent ran out, then we had improvements in the automobile, and we were still making them.
That's the end of tape till the afternoon of January the 7th.